the very small, the particular, that I spent my last few minutes before coming over here helping somebody to look for a small, heart-shaped, blue teddy bear. Was it found? What?
Yes.
It was. It was found. Oh, great. Good. 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 Cardinal Basil Hume. I had great good fortune in the 60s and 70s to work very closely under my own abbot, Basil Hume, and then under Rembert Weakland in St. Anselmo in Rome. And whatever few good Benedictine humanist virtues I may have are very largely due to both those men. Basil Hume, rather like me, is a polyglot in terms of his culture. His father was an agnostic English surgeon, a man of great intelligence and culture. His mother was a French Catholic, so he's bilingual, and became a monk of Ampleforth, the same age as I did, at the age of 18, and worked a lot in the school there first, was a housemaster like I was head of languages like I was, I followed him, and was coach of the school rugby team, and very much an all-rounder. He wouldn't claim to be a great theologian or academic, but as Mimi says, he represents that deep centre of the Catholic tradition as it emerged from Vatican II. I mean, he was abbot with us during the whole period of the implementation of Vatican II, and was a man of great moderation, great capacity to live out what St. Benedict says about the man the abbot should be, always trying to see each person differently, always listening to what the last person said, therefore sometimes finding it difficult to make tough decisions. He says it's been much easier being a cardinal archbishop than being an abbot, in some respects. Is that helpful?
Yes, very.
I hope very much he comes. You'll find him a very warm, gracious, and accessible person, unlike most of us. So be very nice to him, anyhow. He loves people, and he doesn't like. And he won't want to be called Your Eminence or anything like that. He's Father Basil to all of us and to everybody. Father Basil. Okay.
He is
Cardinal Archbishop of London, north of the Thames. There are two dioceses in London. North of the Thames is Westminster, and south of the Thames is Southwark, the Diocese of Southwark. And his cathedral, Westminster Cathedral, is just down the road from Westminster Abbey, where our own monks at Ampleforth started life. I mean, the monks of Ampleforth were originally at Westminster Abbey. We were then expelled from England for being Catholic, and then expelled from France for being English. So that's how we found our way to Yorkshire. Okay. Now let's try and get back into things. In our Abbey Church, one day, I found myself sitting alone. The reason for this was that this was a long time ago when I was in charge of the school theatre. Perhaps it won't surprise you to know that I'm interested in dramatics. But I was in charge of the school theatre and I was producing Macbeth. And it was a very tiring thing to do. And it used to keep me up late at night. And around the time of the performances, which was our parents' prize day, being a boarding school, about 2,000 people come and take possession of the neighborhood and stay there for 2 or 3 days. And it's a very exhausting weekend. And on the Friday night, there was the performance of the play. And on the Saturday morning, there was the prize giving, a great big hall, thousands of people. Well, I was so exhausted after the performance that I decided to play truant and to skip the prize giving. And I just went off to the Abbey Church to sit by myself, not really to pray, but just to unwind, just to be what I'm going to do in Sacramento this weekend. And so I was sitting in a sort of corner. Our choir has got a dark sort of corner to it where I sat. And I was just sitting looking at the Abbey Church, just there, what Jeremy calls looking at the wall. And I heard the sound of footsteps coming up from the crypt, slowly, slowly. And I wondered who it could be. And I knew it was a boy because they were little footsteps. And into the choir came this boy of about 12. And one of the points of the story is that he never saw me. He didn't know I was there. He thought that he was alone in the Abbey Church. And he was skipping the prize giving too. And he came in. He didn't genuflect or make the sign of the cross. He just came in and he stood with a smile on his face, just looking. I thought at first he'd come in to sort of say a prayer and then go out again. But I soon sensed that he'd come because it was the first opportunity that he'd ever had to own the Abbey Church, to have it as his, and to come into the monks' choir. And he stood at our altar with a great stone arch over it, is between the monks' choir and the nave. And he was in the monks' choir looking at the altar with this smile on his face. And then he looked round, fortunately without seeing me, because that would have spoiled everything. I had this kind of privileged view of a little boy who was alone in this space. And then he went up to the monks' choir. And he put his finger on them, and then looked at his fingers, and then he ran. We've got beautiful carved oaks, choir stalls, and he ran his finger along them. I thought he was being like the novice master and seeing if the novices had dusted the choir. And then he looked at his fingertips and felt them, and with this smile on his face. And then he looked again and wandered over slowly to the altar, which got some carved statues round it. And he went up to the altar and put his finger on the stone and ran his hand along the stone and round the forms of the statues and looked at his finger. And then he went back to the wood and did again. And I realized slowly that he was simply rejoicing in the space and in the texture, the touch, the feel of these things. And he stood, the whole process probably lasted about 20 minutes. And for me, it was an extraordinary window into lots of things that I took for granted. It never occurred to me to contemplate the stones of the Abbey Church. They were just there. The choir stalls, well, that was Latins and lords and all the rest of it, and we wandered in and out of them, but I never really looked at or touched the way he was touching these things. And I realized that for him this was an experience of what I can only call glory. He was in the glory of these things. He knew in a sort of way that these things were pointing up the vertical. But for him, they were profoundly horizontal. This was his world. These were his things. They were special things. He'd never had an opportunity to be so close to them before. And he was enjoying. I've never seen such a quiet personal celebration of ordinary things. And he's ever since then, just as I remember each time I eat a banana, I have certain memories. So each time now I look at the choir stalls and look at the arch over the altar, I try gently to remember to look at them through his eyes, because they're just as special now as they were at the moment they were carved and put there. But we get tired of things, and we take so many things for granted that we often lose the sense of glory. And really what I want to end up with this morning is with a sort of celebration of the glory of things that we so often forget, but which are there all round us, and which are a few days like this ought to bring once again to the surface of our minds and our hearts, so that we truly go back renewed in the way we look at everything, not just in the way we say our prayers and being kinder to each other, but renewed in the way we are able to contemplate everything. When we look into the eyes of our children, when we hear their laughter out there and at home, when we listen to music, when anything beautiful crosses our path. I want to quote some lines which struck me many years ago from an unknown, a largely unknown English 16th century poet, but there's one phrase in it which struck home to me and which I've never forgotten. He is talking about, like so much poetry, the beauty of things which flash before us. You know, in early in June, you see the first rose, perhaps you get them earlier here, and you bend down to smell it, and that amazing fragrance of the first rose of summer is always completely new, completely special. In the old days, when in England, when we couldn't get fruit all the way around the year, like you more or less can now, in about this time of year, when we got in the north our first strawberries, the taste of that first strawberry was like a sort of flash of eternity. And this is really my point. It's like a flash of eternity. It's here and it's gone. And for many people, it's got nothing at all to do with eternity. But what does it speak to us about? Anyhow, the lines of the poem go like this. Forsooth, good old English word, forsooth, the present we must give to that which cannot pass away. The beauty of things for which we live, by laws of time and space, decay. But oh, the very reason why I clasp them is because they die. The very reason why I clasp them is because they die. That's the difference between the first rose of June and an artificial flower, however beautiful. You can see occasionally bunches of artificial flowers that look exactly like the real thing. But a week later, they look just the same. And we know that therefore they haven't got the magic. And that particular magic is because they die. And there's a great mystery here, that God has given us myriads of experiences which belong to the moment. We can tape them, we can photograph them, we can record them, we can copy them, but it's not the same, and we know it. The essential quality is in the moment they happen. In my particular case, I can remember the first time I heard there's a particular Mozart string quartet. It is a quintet, a string quintet, one of Mozart's late works. And there's one phrase in it which starts like any old tune, and this, of course, is a feature of Mozart in particular, starts like any old tune, but suddenly, in a flash of a second, it lights up just because of the interval and the little phrase that Mozart has chosen. The whole thing lights up and for a flash becomes, for me, a window into eternity. And the ambiguity, the irony, the paradox is that it's because it's so instantaneous. It's here and then it's gone. It's for that reason that the music speaks to us of eternity. This is the strange, fragile, beautiful rainbow bridge between God's infinity and our time. Now, the world, the horizontal, conceived as being the world without the vertical running through it, looks at these moments in one way, and we, as believers in God, above all believers in the incarnate and risen Jesus Christ, must learn to perceive them in quite a different way. That phrase of Mozart, the beauty of a child's laugh, that sensation of wonder and splendor as we look into the eyes of someone we love and he or she looks at us. For the world, that is something which is, as it were, morally neutral. It passes away. It's just for me. And there is, in the non-believing mind, a separation between what is beautiful in that sense and what is demanding because it is true and good. The medieval philosophers, rooted in the Greeks, spoke of a great trinity of qualities in the world, which they called the transcendentals. The good, the true, and the beautiful. And for the believing medieval philosopher in the tradition of Aquinas, the good, the true, and the beautiful are like a trinity linked together at the heart of the space between the horizontal and the vertical. Because if something is good, in the eyes of God, it is also true. If something is true, that truth is beautiful. And any mathematician or physicist will, from his own instinct, confirm that. When somebody works on a new way of perceiving the physical universe, let us say the quantum theory or DNA, whatever, the moment of discovery when things fit and are manifestly true is like a moment of inventing a symphony. And that instinct for the believer is rooted in the reality of God's creation, where, of course, every word of God speaks God and is therefore true and is therefore good and is therefore a beautiful echo of the harmony of the Holy Trinity. We know that in our faith, but we have a wonderful opportunity in these constant encounters with the beautiful. We have a constant opportunity to realize it in our lives. So when we encounter, like that boy in the Abbey Church, encountering the glory of the cut stone or the carved wood, when we hear that phrase of music which captures our heart, when we rejoice in a moment of unexpected love or friendship, when we see a beautiful building, when you look out of the window, as I did this morning, and suddenly the sun has come out over the valley and is shifting across, and the world says, "That's a great view," and you know, that's good, it's nice to look at. Now, for us, it must be something much more. It's a window into eternity, it's a flash. And so, what I'm really talking about this morning is, for the believer, beauty of all kinds. Because they die, because it's associated with that experience of death with which the Word incarnate wanted to identify himself completely. For us, it is the smile of God. Religion, our religion, any religion, can be a dull thing indeed if it concentrates simply on good behavior and on not sinning. And most people, if they are simply given that teaching, that religion is about being good, will not sustain their commitment to it. What holds our hearts over long periods is if a way of life is presented to us and experienced by us as being beautiful. Why, down the years and down the centuries, do monks and others create beautiful buildings, beautiful spaces, beautiful songs, beautiful gardens? They can't resist it. They need it. A monastery without song, a monastery without flowers somewhere, would be a dull place indeed. So, the culmination of my particular meditation on the horizontal and the vertical is to focus on the joint between the two, where, because the horizontal is penetrated by this presence of God, both as creator in the first place and as the incarnate Word who comes to be the horizontal, to draw us all towards the meeting of the two beings, and thirdly, because that incarnate Word has risen indeed and has taken the whole weight of the horizontal, concentrated it at the heart of the meeting place, and pointed it all and carried it all up the vertical into the mystery of God. That is what we celebrate. And from that point of view, when we hear the Word speaking himself,
we can catch glimpses of that wonderful and terrible beauty. When Jesus says in the Gospel of Matthew, a passage we all know, but rather like the stone of the altar or the wood of the choir, we can pass it by without really hearing. Therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Is not life more than food, and the body more than clothing? Look, he's constantly saying, look at the birds in the sky. They do not sow or reap, they gather nothing into barns, yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are not you more important than they? Can any of you, by worrying, add a single moment to your lifespan? Why are you anxious about clothes? Learn from the way the wild flowers grow. They do not work or spin. But I tell you that not even Solomon, in all his splendor, was clothed like one of these. If God so clothes the grass of the field, which grows today and is thrown into the oven tomorrow, will he not much more provide for you, O you of little faith? So do not worry and say, what are we to eat, what are we to drink, what are we to wear? All these things the pagans seek. Your heavenly Father knows that you need them all, but seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be given you besides. Do not worry about tomorrow. Tomorrow will take care of itself. And by the same token, that beauty, because they die, the reason why I clasp them is because they die. Because that beauty is perishable and is also fragmented by the ugliness of sin, then it can cause very great pain, which we all experience from time to time, sometimes in acute way, sometimes as a dull ache. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the holy city, the monastery on a hill, those places and sights and experiences that we love so much. Jerusalem for the Jewish mind, and that includes Jesus himself, represents a summary, a concentrated version of all possible marriage between natural beauty and human art, fruit of the earth, work of human hands. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those sent to you, how many times I have yearned to gather your children together as a hen gathers her young under her wings. But you would not. Behold, your house will be abandoned, desolate. So our experience is full of those flashes of eternity, the smile of God that comes to us through the encounter with beauty. But it's also full of those contrary and destructive moments of loss, of bereavement, the sense of failure, the sense that the beauty somehow slips away from us and we are doomed to be without it. So, incarnation, death, and resurrection.
She turned round and saw Jesus there, but did not know it was Jesus. And Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you looking for?" She thought it was the gardener and said to him, "Sir, if you carried him away, tell me where you laid him, and I will take him." And Jesus said to her, "Mary." And at that moment, all the previous experience, the love experienced, the growing and complex love experienced by Jesus and Mary as they walked together on the roads towards Calvary, they all come together and are the same, but completely transformed. The first word Jesus speaks, as it were, in the moment of the new creation, of the resurrection, is the name of Mary, Miriam, beloved one. And that experience of the risen Christ is the experience which holds the whole frame together, the horizontal and the vertical. For us who believe, there is the heart of the joint between this horizontal world that we love so much, in which we suffer so much, and the presence of God, Creator, Word incarnate, Jesus risen. And Jesus said to her, "There is no need to hold me. He who constantly touches and is touched says to her, not, 'Do not touch me,' but, 'There is no need to hold me. There is no need to touch me.'" Again, the touch of humor. "I'm still here. I've not yet risen to my Father. But go to my brothers and tell them, I am going to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." So the journey through the horizontal, up the vertical, into the mystery of the Trinity, is a journey traveled in complete unity and equality by Jesus, by Mary, by us. And note, in this account of the resurrection appearance of Jesus, something which characterizes them all. Jesus is profoundly the same, but he is profoundly hard to recognize. He is profoundly different. And it needs some special experience to pass through the difference and recognize the absolute sameness. In the case of Mary, it is the recalling by her intimate name, the recalling of the intimacy of friendship and love between them. In the case of Thomas, it is the touching of the wounds, the close approach to the suffering of Christ. In the case of the disciples on the road to Emmaus, it is first the hearing of the word, which makes their heart burn with them as he spoke to us on the road of Moses and the prophets. And secondly, it's the breaking of bread. It's the sharing. It's the opening up towards each other. In the case of Peter, it's the forgiveness. It's the forgiving and the being forgiven, which breaks through the hesitation that they all felt when they saw and sensed the presence of this same but different Jesus. And here we are being taught that in our ordinary daily lives, it's the intimacy, it's the closeness to suffering, it's the listening, it's the touching of the wounds, it's the breaking of the bread, which brings the risen Christ at the heart of the cross alive to us. But I wanted to emphasize today in this final conference, above all, the accessibility of the Word incarnate to us. We often think that if only we had been there, it would have been easier. But it is not like that. Jesus, the risen Word, is hiding all the time in these moments of encounter, which for the pagan, the unbeliever, the unknowing, may be, as it were, neutral, something that is for my enjoyment and nothing more, and passes away. But for us it is different. I went in London the other day to a great opera, Don Carlos of Verdi, which is a very great work musically and has a very deep and important religious script to it. It is about the encounter between human love and death and religious truth in the context of political violence. It's a very concrete sort of story set in 17th century Spain. And I was thinking when I was there that for most people this is simply good music, fun, and you can slip out into the interval and have a gin and tonic and go home at the end and read the reviews, and it doesn't change your life. But of course, for any believer, for any believing artist, composer, listener, all these experiences represent a challenge and a pointer towards the heart of the cross. What I'd like to do to end, if I may, I didn't know whether I would be able to take the risk, but having been with you for these days, I know I can. I would like to read you a poem, which is a very favourite poem of mine. Some people regard it as a very difficult poem. I regard it as a very structurally complex poem, but with an extremely simple message. And it is about what I've been talking about, written by a Jesuit priest whose life's experience was rooted in the clash between the intense experience of beauty encountered in the natural and in the human world and the call of God coming from way, way, way out there. What is the relation between beauty as we meet it in flashes, in people's faces, all around us? Beauty which we know passes away as they get older and die. What is the link between that and God's eternity to which he is calling us? And he says to us, this Jesus who has said to us, every hair of your head is numbered. Not one sparrow falls to the ground without your heavenly Father knowing about it. And so Gerard Manley Hopkins, experimenting with his free-flowing, sprung rhythm, writes a lovely horizontal vertical poem called The Leaden Echo and the Golden Echo. And it consists of voices echoing each other. And the first voice, which is the leaden echo, speaks of death, and how tragic it is that beautiful things pass away and die, and at the end of the day, there's nothing to do but despair. No matter how much we enjoy the passing moment, when it's gone, it is gone. It is dead and buried. And the golden echo, which comes in and says, no, it's not like that. And in a poetic way, he's saying that the beauty is not lost. It is, in mysterious ways, through the resurrection of Christ, in mysterious ways, kept, captured, preserved forever. And that is the mystery and the glory of the Christian life. So if you like it, well and good, and if you don't, that's just too bad.
Don't expect, if you're not familiar with Hopkins, don't expect to understand it all. That's not the point. It's like music. One doesn't expect to understand or explain music. It's obvious when the leaden echo, which starts, changes to the golden echo.
How to keep? Is there any? Is there none such nowhere known some bow or brooch or braid or brace, lace, latch or catch or key, to keep back beauty? Keep it, beauty, 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 from vanishing away. Oh, is there no frowning of these wrinkles, ranked wrinkles deep down, no waving off of these most mournful messengers, still messengers, sad and stealing messengers of grey? No, there's none. There's none, oh no, there's none. Nor can you long be what you now are, called fair. Do what you may do, what, do what you may, and wisdom is early to despair. Be beginning, since, no, nothing can be done to keep at bay age and age's evils, hoar hair, rack and wrinkle, drooping, dying, death's worst, winding sheets, tombs and worms, and tumbling to decay. So be beginning to despair. Oh, there's none, no, 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 there's none. Be beginning to despair, to despair. Despair, 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 despair. Spare. There is one. Yes, I have one. Hush there. Only not within seeing of the sun, not within the singeing of the strong sun, tall sun's tinging, or treacherous the tainting of the earth's air. Somewhere, elsewhere, there is, ah, well, where? One, one. Yes, I can tell such a key. I do know such a place, where whatever's prized and passes of us, everything that's fresh and fast flying of us, seems to us sweet of us, and swiftly away with, done away with, undone, undone, done with, soon done with, and yet dearly and dangerously sweet of us, the wimpled water dimpled, not by morning matched face, the flower of beauty, fleece of beauty, too apt, too fleet, never fleets more, fastened with the tenderest truth to its own best being and its loveliness of youth. It is an everlastingness of, oh, it is an all youth. Come then, your ways and airs and looks, locks, maiden gear, gallantry and gaiety and grace, winning ways, airs innocent, maiden manners, sweet looks, loose locks, long locks, love locks, gay gear, going gallant, girl grace. Resign them, sign them, seal them, send them, motion them with breath, and with sighs soaring, soaring sighs, deliver them, beauty in the ghost, deliver it, early now, long before death. Give beauty back, beauty, 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 back to God, beauty's self,
and beauty's giver. See, not a hair is, not an eyelash, not the least lash lost. Every hair is, hair of the head, numbered. Nay, what we had light-handed left in surly the mere mould, will have waked and have waxed, and have walked with the wind, what while we slept, this side, that side, hurling a heavy-headed hundredfold, what while we slumbered. Oh, then, weary then, why should we tread? Oh, why are we so haggard at the heart, so care-coiled, care-killed, so fagged, so fashed, so cogged, so cumbered, when the thing we freely forfeit is kept with fonder a care kept than we could have kept it, kept far with fonder a care, and we should have lost it, finer, fonder a care kept. Where kept? Do but tell us, where kept, where? Yonder. What high is that? We follow. Now we follow. Yonder, yes, yonder, yonder.